Other teams of keeping out other black players rose sharply. The net result was that, in a matter of a relatively few years, large numbers of black players flooded into the major leagues. For a period of 7 consecutive years, no white man won the National League's Most Valuable Player award. Had other teams not followed the lead of the Dodgers in hiring black players, all these MVP stars would have become Dodgers, giving Brooklyn a virtual monopoly of National League pennants and perhaps of world championships. This cost was obviously much too high for the competing teams to pay for continuing racial exclusion in Major League Baseball. Their racial attitudes may not have changed, but the cost of translating those attitudes into discriminatory exclusions had changed drastically. Competitive and non-competitive markets. The power of the free market was perhaps best demonstrated in white-ruled South Africa during the era of apartheid. Here, we need not wonder about racial predispositions or about the fact that the vast majority of employers in industry, agriculture, and government were white. Yet, even in a country which became a worldwide symbol of racial oppression, white employers in competitive industries violated official government policy on a massive scale by hiring more black workers and in higher positions than the law allowed. There is no compelling evidence that these particular white employers had different racial predispositions than the white people who administered the apartheid government. What they had were very different costs of discrimination. While government agencies and government-regulated railroads, for example, could maintain apartheid policies at virtually zero cost to themselves, it was a wholly different economic situation for people spending their own money. Home building was a typical example. To build a house in Johannesburg meant either waiting for months for a white, expensive, legal building gang or finding a black gang, perhaps with a white nominally in charge in case an official came inquiring. Most customers opted for the quicker, cheaper service. Such practices became so widespread in South Africa that the white-run apartheid government cracked down in the 1970s, fining hundreds of building construction companies. Moreover, this was by no means the only industry that hired more blacks than they were allowed to by law. In the clothing industry, no blacks at all were allowed to work in certain categories of jobs under the apartheid laws. Yet, as of 1970, blacks were an absolute majority of the workers in those job categories. There were also residential areas in South Africa set aside by law for whites only. And yet, there were not only many non-whites living in these areas, including black American economist Walter Williams, at least one such area had an absolute majority of non-whites. Competition in a free market simply made discrimination too expensive for many, even though violating the apartheid laws also cost money. One of the reasons for the weakening of apartheid, even before the end of white minority rule in South Africa, was that many of the white Afrikaners, the principal supporters of apartheid, rose over the years into the ranks of business owners and now had to pay the costs of discrimination, which before had been paid by British and Jewish business owners. Faced with these costs, many Afrikaners began to lose their enthusiasm for apartheid, and some even spoke out against it, despite the authoritarian and repressive South African government. The expansion of black residential areas into white residential areas has been even more common in the United States. However, this more or less continuous expansion of black ghettos has been in contrast to the history of the original ghettos, those of the Jews in Europe in centuries past. Jewish ghettos in Europe in centuries past tended to become more overcrowded as the Jewish population grew, though there were particular times and places where Jews were allowed to expand an existing ghetto or to set up a new ghetto to accommodate their growing populations. Here again, the difference has been in the economic costs of discrimination. Black ghettos have expanded through the marketplace because of the costs of excluding black renters and homebuyers. This is not to say that there was no resistance by whites. Often there was organized, bitter, and even violent resistance. The key question, however, is, what was the end result? The usual end result was that black ghettos expanded in cities across the country. Moreover, where this expansion was stopped by laws or government policies, by restrictive covenants, or by violence or the threat of violence, that reinforces the point that the costs of discrimination were too great for the expansion of black ghettos to be stopped in the marketplace. By and large, black ghettos continued expanding with the growth of the black population. The boundaries of Jewish ghettos in Europe were not determined by the marketplace, but were established by the dictates of those with political power. Only when these political leaders found it expedient did these boundaries expand. That is why Jewish ghettos tended simply to become more crowded with the passage of time and population growth. There was usually no cost to political leaders for discriminating against Jews. In particular circumstances, when there was a war on, for example, and the rulers needed the help of Jewish financiers, various proscriptions might be eased and more ghettos allowed to be founded to relieve overcrowding. During the Thirty Years' War, 1618 to 1648, for example, new Jewish communities were permitted to be established and new occupations and markets opened up to Jews, while a synagogue was permitted to be built in Vienna for the first time in more than 200 years, and a synagogue was permitted in Denmark for the first time ever. In short, costs of discrimination are not only a fact of life, they are a potent force in actual decision-making, even in countries with strong racial, ethnic, or religious predispositions. How much of a force depends on the economic incentives and constraints in particular sectors. What this means is that not only is the assumed one-to-one correlation between racism and discrimination false, but also that those who wish to reduce discrimination need to pay attention to the economic conditions which make it more expensive or less expensive for decision-makers to discriminate. Too often, however, those opposed to discrimination are also opposed to free competitive markets that make discrimination more costly. They do not think beyond stage one. Even a given market, such as the market for housing or the labor market, for example, can have more discrimination or less discrimination according to whether its prices are determined by supply and demand or are imposed by external agencies such as government, labor unions, or a cartel. For example, when a landlord refuses to rent an apartment to people from the wrong group, that can mean leaving the apartment vacant longer. Clearly, that represents a loss of rent, if this is a free market. However, if there is rent control with a surplus of applicants, then such discrimination may cost the landlord nothing. Similar principles apply in job markets. An employer who refuses to hire qualified individuals from the wrong groups risks leaving his jobs unfilled longer in a free market. This means that he must either leave some work undone and some orders unfilled, or else pay overtime to existing employees to get it done, losing money either way. However, in a market where wages are set artificially above the level that would exist through supply and demand, the resulting surplus of applicants can mean that discrimination costs the employer nothing. Whether these artificially higher wages are set by a labor union or by a minimum wage law does not change the principle. In all these cases, the crucial factors in the cost of discrimination have been the presence or absence of competition, and whether those making the decisions have been spending their own money or someone else's money. When one's own money is at stake, groups hostile to each other may not only fail to discriminate, they may in fact seek each other out. A landmark study of Polish immigrants and Jewish immigrants from Poland in early 20th century Chicago reported, "The Poles and the Jews in Chicago have a profound feeling of disrespect and contempt for each other, bred by their contiguity and by historical friction in the Pale, but they trade with each other on Milwaukee Avenue and on Maxwell Street. A study of numerous cases shows that not only do many Jews open their businesses on Milwaukee Avenue and Division Street because they know that the Poles are the predominant population in these neighborhoods, but the Poles come from all over the city to trade on Maxwell Street because they know that there they can find the familiar street stands owned by Jews." Income distribution. Variations in income can be viewed empirically, on the one hand, or in terms of moral judgments on the other. Most of the contemporary intelligentsia do both. But in order to assess the validity of the conclusions they reach, it is advisable to assess the empirical issues and the moral issues separately, rather than attempt to go back and forth between the two, with any expectation of rational coherence. Empirical evidence. Given the vast amounts of statistical data on income available from the Census Bureau, the Internal Revenue Service, and innumerable research institutes and projects, one might imagine that the bare facts about variations in income would be fairly well known by informed people, even though they might have differing opinions as to the desirability of those particular variations. In reality, however, the most fundamental facts are in dispute, and variations in what are claimed to be facts seem to be at least as great as variations in incomes. Both the magnitude of income variations and the trends in these variations over time are seen in radically different terms by those with different visions as regards the current reality, even aside from what people may regard as desirable for the future. Perhaps the most fertile source of misunderstandings about incomes has been the widespread practice of confusing statistical categories with flesh-and-blood human beings. Many statements have been made in the media and in academia, claiming that the rich are gaining not only larger incomes, but a growing share of all incomes, widening the income gap between people at the top and those at the bottom. Almost invariably, these statements are based on confusing what has been happening over time in statistical categories with what has been happening over time with actual flesh-and-blood people. A New York Times editorial, for example, declared that the gap between rich and poor has widened in America. Similar conclusions appeared in a 2007 Newsweek article, which referred to this era as a time when the gap is growing between the rich and the poor, and the super-rich and the merely rich, a theme common in such other well-known media outlets as the Washington Post and innumerable television programs. The rich have seen far greater income gains than have the poor, according to Washington Post columnist Eugene Robinson. A writer in the Los Angeles Times likewise declared, "The gap between rich and poor is growing." According to Professor Andrew Hacker in his book Money, while all segments of the population enjoyed an increase in income, the top fifth did 24 times better than the bottom fifth, and measured by their shares of the aggregate, not just the bottom fifth, but the three above it, all ended up losing ground. E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post described the wealthy as people who have made almost all the income gains in recent years, and added that they are undertaxed. Although such discussions have been phrased in terms of people, the actual empirical evidence cited has been about what has been happening over time to statistical categories, and that turns out to be the direct opposite of what has happened over time to flesh-and-blood human beings, most of whom move from one income category to another over time. In terms of statistical categories, it is indeed true that both the amount of income and the proportion of all income received by those in the top 20% bracket have risen over the years, widening the gap between the top and bottom quintiles. But U.S. Treasury Department data, following specific individuals over time from their tax returns to the Internal Revenue Service, show that in terms of people, the incomes of those particular taxpayers who were in the bottom 20% in income in 1996 rose 91% by 2005, while the incomes of those particular taxpayers who were in the top 20% in 1996 rose by only 10% by 2005, and the incomes of those in the top 5% and top 1% actually declined. While it might seem as if both these radically different sets of statistics cannot be true at the same time, what makes them mutually compatible is that flesh-and-blood human beings move from one statistical category to another over time. When those taxpayers who were initially in the lowest income bracket had their incomes nearly double in a decade, that moved many of them up and out of the bottom quintile. And when those in the top 1% had their incomes cut by about one-fourth, that may well have dropped many, if not most, of them out of the top 1%. Internal Revenue Service data can follow particular individuals over time from their tax returns, which have individual Social Security numbers as identification, while data from the Census Bureau and most other sources follow what happens to statistical categories over time, even though it is not the same individuals in the same categories over the years. Many of the same kinds of data used to claim a widening income gap between the rich and the poor, names usually given to people with different incomes rather than different wealth, as the terms rich and poor might seem to imply, have led many in the media to likewise claim a growing income gap between the super-rich and the merely rich. Under the headline, "Richest are leaving even the rich far behind," a front-page New York Times article dubbed "The Top 0.1% of Income Earners, the Top 1,000th, as the Hyper-Rich," and declared that they have even left behind people making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. Once again, the confusion is between what is happening to statistical categories over time and what is happening to flesh-and-blood individuals over time as they move from one statistical category to another. Despite the rise in the income of the top 0.1% of taxpayers as a statistical category, both absolutely and relative to the incomes in other categories, as flesh-and-blood human beings, those individuals who were in that category initially had their incomes actually fall by a whopping 50% between 1996 and 2005. It is hardly surprising when people whose incomes are cut in half drop out of the top 0.1%. What happens to the income of the category over time is not the same as what happens to the people who were in that category at any given point in time. But many among the intelligentsia are ready to seize upon any numbers that seem to fit their vision. It is much the same story with data on the top 400 income earners in the country. As with other data, data on those who were among the top 400 income earners from 1992 to 2000 were not data on the same 400 people throughout the span of time covered. During that span, there were thousands of people in the top 400, which is to say, turnover was high. Fewer than one-fourth of all the people in that category during that span of years were in that category more than 1 year, and fewer than 13% were in that category more than 2 years. Behind many of those numbers and the accompanying alarmist rhetoric is a very mundane fact. Most people begin their working careers at the bottom, earning entry-level salaries. Over time, as they acquire more skills and experience, their rising productivity leads to rising pay, putting them in successively higher income brackets. These are not rare Horatio Alger stories. These are common patterns among millions of people in the United States and in some other countries. More than three-quarters of those working Americans whose incomes were in the bottom 20% in 1975 were also in the top 40% of income earners at some point by 1991. Only 5% of those who were initially in the bottom quintile were still there in 1991, while 29% of those who were initially at the bottom quintile had risen to the top quintile. Yet verbal virtuosity has transformed a transient cohort in a given statistical category into an enduring class called the poor. Just as most Americans in statistical categories identified as the poor are not an enduring class there, studies in Britain, Canada, New Zealand, and Greece show similar patterns of transience among those in low-income brackets at a given time. Just over half of all Americans earning at or near the minimum wage are from 16 to 24 years of age, and of course these individuals cannot remain from 16 to 24 years of age indefinitely, though that age category can of course continue indefinitely, providing many intellectuals with data to fit their preconceptions. Only by focusing on the income brackets, instead of the actual people moving between those brackets, have the intelligentsia been able to verbally create a problem for which a solution is necessary. They have created a powerful vision of classes with disparities and inequities in income, caused by barriers created by society. But the routine rise of millions of people out of the lowest quintile over time makes a mockery of the barriers assumed by many, if not most, of the intelligentsia. Far from using their intellectual skills to clarify the distinction between statistical categories and flesh-and-blood human beings, the intelligentsia have instead used their verbal virtuosity to equate the changing numerical relationship between statistical categories over time with a changing relationship between flesh-and-blood human beings, the rich and the poor, over time, even though data that follow individual income earners over time tell a diametrically opposite story from that of data which follow the statistical categories which people are moving into and out of over time. The confusion between statistical categories and flesh-and-blood human beings is compounded when there is confusion between income and wealth. People called rich or super-rich have been given these titles by the media on the basis of income, not wealth, even though being rich means having more wealth. According to the Treasury Department, among those with the very highest incomes in 1996, the top 1/100th of 1%, only 25% remained in this group in 2005. If these were genuinely super-rich people, it is hard to explain why 3/4 of them are no longer in that category a decade later. A related but somewhat different confusion between statistical categories and human beings has led to many claims in the media and in academia that Americans' incomes have stagnated or grown only very slowly over the years. For example, over the entire period from 1967 to 2005, median real household income, that is, money income adjusted for inflation, rose by 31%. For selected periods within that long span, real household incomes rose even less, and those selected periods have often been cited by the intelligentsia to claim that income and living standards have stagnated. Meanwhile, real per capita income rose by 122% over that same span, from 1967 to 2005. When a more than doubling of real income per person is called stagnation, that is one of the many feats of verbal virtuosity. The reason for the large discrepancy between growth rate trends in household income and growth rate trends in individual income is very straightforward. The number of persons per household has been declining over the years. As early as 1966, the U.S. Bureau of the Census reported that the number of households was increasing faster than the number of people, and concluded, "The main reason for the more rapid rate of household formation is the increased tendency, particularly among unrelated individuals, to maintain their own homes or apartments, rather than live with relatives or move into existing households as roomers, lodgers, and so forth. Increasing individual incomes made this possible. As late as 1970, 21% of American households contained 5 or more people, but by 2007, only 10% did. Despite such obvious and mundane facts, household or family income statistics continue to be widely cited in the media and in academia, and per capita income statistics widely ignored, despite the fact that households are variable in size, while per capita income always refers to the income of one person. However, the statistics that the intelligentsia keep citing are much more consistent with their vision of America than the statistics they keep ignoring. Just as household statistics understate the rise in the American standard of living over time, they overstate the degree of income inequality, since lower-income households tend to have fewer people than upper-income households. While there are 39 million people in households whose incomes are in the bottom 20%, there are 64 million people in households whose incomes are in the top 20%. There is nothing mysterious about this either, given the number of low-income mothers living with fatherless children and low-income lodgers in single-room occupancy hotels or rooming houses, for example. Even if every person in the entire country received exactly the same income, there would still be a significant disparity between the average incomes received by households containing 64 million people compared to the average incomes received by households containing 39 million people. That disparity would be even greater if only the incomes of working adults were counted, even if those working adults all had identical incomes. There are more adult heads of household working full-time and year-round in even the top 5% of households than in the bottom 20% of households. Many income statistics are misleading in another sense, when they leave out the income received in kind, such as food stamps and subsidized housing, which often exceeds the value of the cash income received by people in the lower income brackets. In 2001, for example, transfers in cash or in kind accounted for more than three-quarters of the total economic resources at the disposal of people in the bottom 20%. In other words, the standard of living of people in the bottom quintile is about three times what the income statistics would indicate. As we shall see, their personal possessions are far more consistent with this fact than with the vision of the intelligentsia. Moral considerations. The difference between statistical categories and actual people affects moral as well as empirical issues. However concerned we might be about the economic fate of flesh and blood human beings, that is very different from being alarmed or outraged about the fate of statistical categories. Michael Harrington's best-selling book, The Other America, for example, dramatized income statistics, lamenting the anguish of the poor in America, tens of millions maimed in body and spirit, constituting the shame of the other America, people caught in a vicious circle and suffering a warping of the will and spirit that is a consequence of being poor. But investing statistical data with moral angst does nothing to establish a connection between a transient cohort in statistical categories and an enduring class conjured up through verbal virtuosity. There was a time when such rhetoric might have made some sense in the United States, and there are other countries where it may still make sense today. But most of those Americans now living below the official poverty line have possessions once considered part of a middle-class standard of living just a generation or so ago. As of 2001, three-quarters of Americans with incomes below the official poverty level had air conditioning, which only one-third of Americans had in 1971. 97% had color television, which fewer than half of Americans had in 1971. 73% owned a microwave oven, which fewer than 1% of Americans had in 1971. And 98% of the poor had either a video cassette recorder or a DVD player, which no one had in 1971. In addition, 72% of the poor owned a motor vehicle. None of this has done much to change the rhetoric of the intelligentsia, however much it may reflect changes in the standard of living of Americans in the lower income brackets. Typical of the mindset of many intellectuals was a book by Andrew Hacker, which referred to the trillions of dollars that become the personal income of Americans each year, and said, "Just how this money is apportioned will be the subject of this book." But this money is not apportioned at all. It becomes income through an entirely different process. The very phrase income distribution is tendentious. It starts the economic story in the middle, with a body of income or wealth existing somehow, leaving only the question as to how that income or wealth is to be distributed or apportioned, as Professor Hacker puts it. In the real world, the situation is quite different. In a market economy, most people receive income as a result of what they produce, supplying other people with some goods or services that those people want, even if that service is only labor. Each recipient of these goods and services pays according to the value which that particular recipient puts on what is received, choosing, among alternative suppliers, to find the best combination of price and quality, both as judged by the individual who is paying. This mundane, utilitarian process is quite different from the vision of income distribution projected by those among the intelligentsia who invest that vision with moral angst. If there really were some pre-existing body of income or wealth, produced somehow, manna from heaven, as it were, then there would of course be a moral question as to how large a share each member of society should receive. But wealth is produced. It does not just exist somehow. where millions of individuals are paid according to how much what they produce is valued subjectively by millions of other individuals, it is not at all clear on what basis third parties could say that some goods or services are overvalued or undervalued, that cooking should be valued more or carpentry should be valued less, for example, much less that not working at all is not rewarded enough compared to working. Nor is there anything mysterious in the fact that at least 1,000 times as many people would pay to hear Pavarotti sing as would pay to hear the average person sing. Where people are paid for what they produce, one person's output can easily be worth 1,000 times as much as another person's output to those who are the recipients of that output, if only because thousands more people are interested in receiving some products or services than are interested in receiving other products and services, or even the same product or service from someone else. For example, when Tiger Woods left the golf tournament circuit for several months because of an injury, television audiences for the final round of major tournaments declined by varying amounts, ranging up to 61%. That can translate into millions of dollars worth of advertising revenue, based on the number of television viewers. The fact that one person's productivity may be 1,000 times as valuable as another's does not mean that one person's merit is 1,000 times as great as another's. Productivity and merit are very different things, though the two things are often confused with one another. An individual's productivity is affected by innumerable factors besides the efforts of that individual, being born with a great voice being an obvious example. Being raised in a particular home with a particular set of values and behavior patterns, living in a particular geographic or social environment, merely being born with a normal brain, rather than a brain damaged during the birth process, can make enormous differences in what a given person is capable of producing. Moreover, third parties are in no position to second-guess the felt value of someone's productivity to someone else, and it is hard even to conceive how someone's merit could be judged accurately by another human being who never walked in his shoes. An individual raised in terrible home conditions or terrible social conditions may be laudable for having become an average, decent citizen with average work skills as a shoe repairer, while someone raised from birth with every advantage that money and social position can confer may be no more laudable for becoming an eminent brain surgeon. But that is wholly different from saying that repairing shoes is just as valuable to others as being able to repair maladies of the brain. To say that merit may be the same is not to say that productivity is the same, nor can we logically or morally ignore the discrepancy in the relative urgency of those who want their shoes repaired versus those in need of brain surgery. In other words, it is not a question of simply weighing the interest of one income recipient versus the interest of another income recipient, while ignoring the vastly larger number of other people whose well-being depends on what these individuals produce. If one prefers an economy in which income is divorced from productivity, then the case for that kind of economy needs to be made explicitly. But that is wholly different from making such a large and fundamental change on the basis of verbal virtuosity in depicting the issue as being simply that of one set of income distribution statistics today versus an alternative set of income distribution statistics tomorrow. As for the moral question, whether any given set of human beings can be held responsible for disparities in other people's productivity and consequent earnings, depends on how much control any given set of human beings has maintained, or can possibly maintain, over the innumerable factors which have led to existing differences in productivity. Since no human being has control over the past, and many deeply ingrained cultural differences are a legacy of the past, limitations on what can be done in the present are limitations on what can be regarded as moral failings by society. Still less can statistical differences between groups be automatically attributed to barriers created by society. Barriers exist in the real world, just as cancer exists. But acknowledging that does not mean that all deaths, or even most deaths, can be automatically attributed to cancer, or that most economic differences can be automatically attributed to barriers, however fashionable this latter non sequitur may be in some quarters. Within the constraints of circumstances, there are things which can be done to make opportunities more widely available or to help those whose handicaps are too severe to expect them to utilize whatever opportunities are already available. In fact, much has already been done and is still being done in a country like the United States, which leads the world in philanthropy, not only in terms of money, but also in terms of individuals donating their time to philanthropic endeavors. But only by assuming that everything that has not been done could have been done, disregarding costs and risks, can individuals or societies be blamed because the real world does not match some vision of an ideal society. Nor can the discrepancy between the real and the vision of the ideal be automatically blamed on the existing reality, as if visionaries cannot possibly be mistaken. Minimum wage laws. Minimum wage laws make it illegal to pay less than the government-specified price for labor. By the simplest and most basic economics, a price artificially raised tends to cause more to be supplied and less to be demanded than when prices are left to be determined by supply and demand in a free market. The result is a surplus, whether the price that is set artificially high is that of farm produce or labor. Making it illegal to pay less than a given amount does not make a worker's productivity worth that amount, and, if it is not, that worker is unlikely to be employed. Yet minimum wage laws are almost always discussed politically in terms of the benefits they confer on workers receiving those wages. Unfortunately, the real minimum wage is always zero, regardless of the laws, and that is the wage that many workers receive in the wake of the creation or escalation of a government-mandated minimum wage, because they either lose their jobs or fail to find jobs when they enter the labor force. The logic is plain, and an examination of the empirical evidence from various countries around the world tends to back up that logic, as we shall see. Unemployment. Because the government does not hire surplus labor the way it buys surplus agricultural output, a labor surplus takes the form of unemployment, which tends to be higher under minimum wage laws than in a free market. Unemployed workers are not surplus in the sense of being useless or in the sense that there is no work around that needs doing. Most of these workers are perfectly capable of producing goods and services, even if not to the same extent as more skilled or more experienced workers. The unemployed are made idle by wage rates artificially set above the level of their productivity. Those who are idled in their youth are, of course, delayed in acquiring the job skills and experience which could make them more productive, and therefore higher earners, later on. That is, they not only lose the low pay that they could have earned in an entry-level job, they lose the higher pay that they could have moved on to and begun earning after gaining experience in entry-level jobs. Younger workers are disproportionately represented among people with low rates of pay. Only about 2% of American workers over the age of 24 earn the minimum wage. Although most modern industrial societies have minimum wage laws, not all do. Switzerland and Hong Kong have been among the exceptions, and both have had very low unemployment rates. In 2003, The Economist magazine reported, Switzerland's unemployment neared a five-year high of 3.9% in February. Back in 1991, when Hong Kong was still a British colony, its unemployment rate was below 2%. Although Hong Kong still did not have a minimum wage law at the end of the 20th century, in 1997, new amendments to its labor law under China's rule mandated many new benefits for workers to be paid for by their employers. This imposed increase in labor costs was followed, predictably, by a higher unemployment rate that reached 7.3% in 2002. Not high by European standards, but a multiple of what it had been for years. In 2003, Hong Kong's unemployment rate hit a new high, 8.3%. Higher costs for a given quantity and quality of labor tend to produce less employment, just as higher prices for other things tend to produce fewer sales. Moreover, higher costs in the form of mandated benefits have the same economic effect as higher costs in the form of minimum wage laws. The explicit minimum wage rate understates the labor costs imposed by European governments, which also mandate various employer contributions to pension plans and health benefits, among other things. Europe's unemployment rates shot up when such government-mandated benefits to be paid for by employers grew sharply during the 1980s and 1990s. In Germany, such benefits accounted for half of the average labor cost per hour. By comparison, such benefits accounted for less than one-fourth the average labor costs per hour in Japan and the United States. Average hourly compensation of manufacturing employees in the European Union countries in general is higher than in the United States or Japan. So is unemployment. Comparisons of Canada with the United States show similar patterns. Over a five-year period, Canadian provinces had minimum wage rates that were a higher percentage of output per capita than in American states, and unemployment rates were correspondingly higher in Canada, as was the average duration of unemployment, while the Canadian rate of job creation lagged behind that in the United States. Over this five-year period, three Canadian provinces had unemployment rates in excess of 10%, with a high of 16.9% in Newfoundland, but none of the 50 American states averaged unemployment rates in double digits over that same five-year period. A belated recognition of the connection between minimum wage laws and unemployment by government officials has caused some countries to allow their real minimum wage levels to be eroded by inflation, avoiding the political risks of trying to repeal these laws explicitly, when so many voters think of such laws as being beneficial to workers. These laws are in fact beneficial to those workers who continue to be employed, those who are on the inside looking out, but at the expense of the unemployed, who are on the outside looking in. Labor unions also benefit from minimum wage laws, and are among the strongest proponents of such laws, even though their own members typically make much more than the minimum wage rate. There is a reason for this. Just as most goods and services can be produced with either much labor and little capital, or vice versa, so can most things be produced using varying proportions of low-skilled labor and high-skilled labor, depending on their relative costs. Thus, experienced unionized workers are competing for employment against younger, inexperienced, and less skilled workers, whose pay is likely to be at or near the minimum wage. The higher the minimum wage goes, the more the unskilled and inexperienced workers are likely to be displaced by more experienced and higher-skilled unionized workers. Just as businesses seek to have government impose tariffs on imported goods that compete with their products, so labor unions use minimum wage laws as tariffs to force up the price of non-union labor that competes with their members for jobs. Among 2 million Americans earning no more than the minimum wage in the early 21st century, just over half were from 16 to 24 years of age, and 62% of them worked part-time. Yet political campaigns to increase the minimum wage often talk in terms of providing a living wage sufficient to support a family of four, such families as most minimum wage workers do not have and would be ill-advised to have before they reach the point where they can feed and clothe their children. The average family income of a minimum wage worker is more than $44,000 a year, far more than can be earned by someone working at minimum wages. But 42% of minimum wage workers live with parents or some other relative. Only 15% of minimum wage workers are supporting themselves and a dependent, the kind of person envisioned by those who advocate a living wage. Nevertheless, a number of American cities have passed living wage laws, which are essentially local minimum wage laws specifying a higher wage rate than the national minimum wage law. Their effects have been similar to the effects of national minimum wage laws in the United States and other countries. That is, the poorest people have been the ones who have most often lost jobs. The huge financial, political, emotional, and ideological investment of various groups in issues revolving around minimum wage laws means that dispassionate analysis is not always the norm. Moreover, the statistical complexities of separating out the effects of minimum wage rates on employment from all the other ever-changing variables which also affect employment mean that honest differences of opinion are possible. However, when all is said and done, most empirical studies indicate that minimum wage laws reduce employment in general, and especially the employment of younger, less skilled, and minority workers. A majority of professional economists surveyed in Britain, Germany, Canada, Switzerland, and the United States agreed that minimum wage laws increase unemployment among low-skilled workers. Economists in France and Austria did not. However, the majority among Canadian economists was 85%, and among American economists was 90%. Dozens of studies of the effects of minimum wages in the United States and dozens more studies of the effects of minimum wages in various countries in Europe, Latin America, the Caribbean, Indonesia, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand were reviewed in 2006 by two economists at the National Bureau of Economic Research. They concluded that, despite the various approaches and methods used in these studies, this literature as a whole was one largely solidifying the conventional view that minimum wages reduce employment among low-skilled workers. Those officially responsible for administering minimum wage laws, such as the U.S. Department of Labor and various local agencies, prefer to claim that these laws do not create unemployment. So do labor unions, which have a vested interest in such laws as protection for their own members' jobs. In South Africa, for example, the Economist reported, the main union body, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, says joblessness has nothing to do with labor laws. The problem, it says, is that businesses are not trying hard enough to create jobs. In Britain, the Low Pay Commission, which sets the minimum wage, has likewise resisted the idea that the wages it set were responsible for an unemployment rate of 17.3% among workers under the age of 25, at a time when the overall unemployment rate was 7.6%. Even though most studies show that unemployment tends to increase as minimum wages are imposed or increased, those few studies that seem to indicate otherwise have been hailed in some quarters as having refuted this myth. However, one common problem with some research on the employment effects of minimum wage laws is that surveys of employers before and after a minimum wage increase can survey only those particular businesses which survived in both periods. Given the high rates of business failures in many industries, the results for the surviving businesses may be completely different from the results for the industry as a whole. Using such research methods, you could interview people who have played Russian roulette and prove from their experiences that it is a harmless activity, since those for whom it was not harmless are unlikely to be around to be interviewed. Thus, you would have refuted the myth that Russian roulette is dangerous. Even an activist organization that has been promoting living wage laws, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN, sought to get its own employees exempted from minimum wage laws. Its argument? The more that ACORN must pay each individual outreach worker, either because of minimum wage or overtime requirements, the fewer outreach workers it will be able to hire. It would be comforting to believe that the government can simply decree higher pay for low-wage workers without having to worry about unfortunate repercussions, but the preponderance of evidence indicates that labor is not exempt from the basic economic principle that artificially high prices cause surpluses. In the case of surplus human beings, that can be a special tragedy when they are already from low-income, unskilled, or minority backgrounds and urgently need to get on the job ladder if they are ever to move up the ladder by acquiring experience and skills. Conceivably, the income benefits to those low-wage workers who keep their jobs could outweigh the losses to those who lose their jobs, producing a net benefit to low-income individuals and families as a whole, at least in the short run, ignoring the long-run consequences of a failure of many low-skilled people to acquire job experience and skills, which could be a larger economic loss in the long run than the loss of pay in an entry-level job. But to say that there might conceivably be benefits to low-income people does not mean that this will in fact happen. A study of the effects of minimum wages in Brazil explored this possibility. The purpose of this study is to examine whether the minimum wage in Brazil has beneficial effects on the distribution of family incomes, in particular, raising incomes of low-income families. While such distributional effects are the most common rationale for minimum wages, economic theory makes no prediction that they will occur. Minimum wages are predicted to reduce employment, and research for both Brazil and the United States tends to confirm this prediction. But all this implies is that minimum wages will harm some workers while benefiting others. The distributional effects depend on the magnitudes of the gains and losses, and where they occur in the income distribution, a purely empirical question. Research for the United States finds no gains to low-income families from minimum wage increases, and if anything, increases in poverty. Overall, then, we do not regard the evidence as lending support to the view that minimum wages in Brazil have beneficial distributional effects from the perspective of low-income families. Unemployment varies not only in its quantity as of a given time, it varies also in how long workers remain unemployed. Like the unemployment rate, the duration of unemployment varies considerably from country to country. Countries which drive up labor costs with either high minimum wages or generous employee benefits imposed on employers by law, or both, tend to have longer-lasting unemployment, as well as higher rates of unemployment. In Germany, for example, there is no minimum wage law, but government-imposed mandates on employers, job security laws, and strong labor unions artificially raise labor costs anyway. Unemployment in Germany lasts 12 months or longer for more than half the unemployed, while in the United States, only about 10% of the unemployed stay unemployed that long. Differential impact. Because people differ in many ways, those who are unemployed are not likely to be a random sample of the labor force. In country after country around the world, those whose employment prospects are reduced most by minimum wage laws are those who are younger, less experienced, or less skilled. This pattern has been found in New Zealand, France, Canada, the Netherlands, and the United States, for example. It should not be surprising that those whose productivity falls furthest short of the minimum wage would be the ones most likely to be unable to find a job. In early 21st century France, the national unemployment rate was 10%, but among workers under the age of 25, the unemployment rate was more than 20%. In Belgium, the unemployment rate for workers under the age of 25 was 22%, and in Italy, 27%. During the global downturn in 2009, the unemployment rate for workers under the age of 25 was 21% in the European Union countries as a whole, with more than 25% in Italy and Ireland, and more than 40% in Spain. In Australia, the lowest unemployment rate for workers under the age of 25 during the entire period from 1978 to 2002 never fell below 10%, while the highest unemployment rate for the population in general barely reached 10% once during that same period. Australia has an unusually high minimum wage, relatively speaking, since its minimum wage level is nearly 60% of that country's median wage rate, while the minimum wage in the United States is just over one-third of the American median wage rate. Some countries in Europe set lower minimum wage rates for teenagers than for adults, and New Zealand simply exempted teenagers from the coverage of its minimum wage law until 1994. This was tacit recognition of the fact that those workers less in demand were likely to be hardest hit by unemployment created by minimum wage laws. Another group disproportionately affected by minimum wage laws are members of unpopular racial or ethnic minority groups. Indeed, minimum wage laws were once advocated explicitly because of the likelihood that such laws would reduce or eliminate the competition of particular minorities, whether they were Japanese in Canada during the 1920s or blacks in the United States and South Africa during the same era. Such expressions of overt racial discrimination were both legal and socially accepted in all three countries at that time. Again, it is necessary to note how price is a factor even in racial discrimination. That is, surplus labor resulting from minimum wage laws makes it cheaper to discriminate against minority workers than it would be in a free market, where there is no chronic excess supply of labor. Passing up qualified minority workers in a free market means having to hire more other workers to take the jobs they were denied, and that in turn usually means either having to raise the pay to attract the additional workers or lowering the job qualifications at the existing pay level, both of which amount to the same thing economically, higher labor costs for getting a given amount of work done. The history of black workers in the United States illustrates the point. From the late 19th century on through the middle of the 20th century, the labor force participation rate of American blacks was slightly higher than that of American whites. In other words, blacks were just as employable at the wages they received as whites were at their very different wages. The minimum wage law changed that. Before federal minimum wage laws were instituted in the 1930s, the black unemployment rate was slightly lower than the white unemployment rate in 1930. But then followed the Davis-Bacon Act of 1931, the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, and the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, all of which imposed government-mandated minimum wages, either on a particular sector or more broadly. The National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which promoted unionization, also tended to price black workers out of jobs, in addition to union rules that kept blacks from jobs by barring them from union membership. The National Industrial Recovery Act raised wage rates in the southern textile industry by 70% in just 5 months, and its impact nationwide was estimated to have cost blacks 500,000 jobs. While this act was later declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was upheld by the High Court and became the major force establishing a national minimum wage. The inflation of the 1940s largely nullified the effect of the Fair Labor Standards Act until it was amended in 1950 to raise minimum wages to a level that would have some actual effect on current wages. By 1954, black unemployment rates were double those of whites and have continued to be at that level or higher. Those particularly hard hit by the resulting unemployment have been black teenage males. Even though 1949, the year before a series of minimum wage escalations began, was a recession year, black teenage male unemployment that year was lower than it was to be at any time during the later boom years of the 1960s. The wide gap between the unemployment rates of black and white teenagers dates from the escalation of the minimum wage and the spread of its coverage in the 1950s. The usual explanations of high unemployment among black teenagers, inexperience, less education, lack of skills, racism, cannot explain their rising unemployment, since all these things were worse during the earlier period when black teenage unemployment was much lower. Taking the more normal year of 1948 as a basis for comparison, black male teenage unemployment then was less than half of what it would be at any time during the decade of the 1960s and less than one-third of what it would be in the 1970s. Unemployment among 16- and 17-year-old black males was no higher than among white males of the same age in 1948. It was only after a series of minimum wage escalations began that black male teenage unemployment not only skyrocketed, but became more than double the unemployment rates among white male teenagers. In the early 21st century, the unemployment rate for black teenagers exceeded 30%. After the American economy turned down in the wake of the housing and financial crises, unemployment among black teenagers reached 40%. The role of economics. Among the questions often raised about the history of economic analysis are, 1. Is economics scientific, or is it just a set of opinions and ideological biases? And 2. Do economic ideas reflect surrounding circumstances and events and change with those circumstances and events? Scientific analysis. There is no question that economists as individuals have their own respective preferences and biases as do all individuals, including mathematicians and physicists. But the reason mathematics and physics are not considered to be mere subjective opinions and biased notions is that there are accepted procedures for testing and proving beliefs in these disciplines. It is precisely because individual scientists are likely to have biases that scientists in general seek to create and agree upon scientific methods and procedures that are unbiased, so that individual biases may be deterred or exposed. In economics, the preferences of Keynesian economists for government intervention and of University of Chicago economists for relying on markets instead of government may well have influenced their initial reactions to the analysis and data of the Phillips curve, for example. But the fact that they shared a common set of analytical and empirical procedures in their professional work enabled them to reach common conclusions as more data came in over time, undermining the Phillips curve. Controversies have raged in science, but what makes a particular field scientific is not automatic unanimity on particular issues, but a commonly accepted set of procedures for resolving differences about issues when there are sufficient data available. Einstein's theory of relativity was not initially accepted by most physicists, nor did Einstein want it accepted without some empirical tests. When the behavior of light during an eclipse of the sun provided a test of his theory, the unexpected results convinced other scientists that he was right. A leading historian of science, Thomas Kuhn, has argued that what distinguishes science from other fields is that mutually contradictory theories cannot coexist indefinitely in science, but that one or the other must prevail and the others disappear when enough of the right data become available. Thus, the phlogiston theory of combustion gave way to the oxygen theory of combustion, and the Ptolemaic theory of astronomy gave way to the Copernican theory. The history of ideologies, however, is quite different from the history of science. Mutually contradictory ideologies can coexist for centuries, with no resolution of their differences in sight, or perhaps even conceivable. What scientists share is not simply agreement on various conclusions, but more fundamentally, agreement about the ways of testing and verifying conclusions, beginning with a careful and strict definition of the terms being used. The crucial importance of definitions in economics has been demonstrated, for example, by the fallacies that result when popular discussions of economic policies use a loose term like wages to refer to such different things as wage rates per unit of time, aggregate earnings of workers, and labor costs per unit of output. A prosperous country with higher wage rates per unit of time may have lower labor costs per unit of output than a third world country where workers are not paid nearly as much. Mathematical presentations of arguments, whether in science or economics, not only make these arguments more compact and their complexities easier to follow than a longer verbal presentation would be, but can also make their implications clearer and their flaws harder to hide. For example, when preparing a landmark 1931 scholarly article on economics, one later reprinted for decades thereafter, Professor Jacob Viner of the University of Chicago instructed a draftsman on how he wanted certain complex cost curves constructed. The draftsman replied that one of the set of curves with which Professor Viner wanted to illustrate the analysis in his article was impossible to draw with all the characteristics that Viner had specified. As Professor Viner later recognized, he had asked for something that was technically impossible and economically inappropriate, because some of the assumptions in his analysis were